This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents The Book of Awesome. Written by Neil Pasricha, performed by Therese Plummer, Aaron Moon, Neil Heligers, Jesse Einstein, Josh Hurley, and Kevin Free, with a special introduction written and performed by the author.
Hey everybody. This is Neil Pasricha, and this is The Book of Awesome. Now, The Book of Awesome has been out almost 10 years, and we are finally putting it out as an audiobook. Took a while, but from an initial printing of only a few thousand copies, it's gone on to sell millions around the world. But in the original book, I never actually shared where it came from. I never shared the true story of why I started writing down these awesome things. So as it comes out in audio now for the first time, I thought I'd take a couple minutes and tell you why I started writing down little essays about getting called up to the dinner buffet first at a wedding, playing on old dangerous playground equipment, and wearing warm underwear from out of the dryer. The story goes like this. One day I was driving home from my office job in the suburbs, and my wife was waiting for me on our front porch. If you've ever had someone waiting for you outside your own house, you know your heart kind of skips a beat. She had been crying and kind of brought me inside, and she summoned a lot of courage through a lot of tears to say, "I don't know if I love you anymore." And in the most kind and respectful way she could, she was asking me for a divorce. A few days later, I chatted with my best friend Chris on the phone on a Sunday night. Chris had been struggling with mental illness for a long time, like one in four of us do. And the year before was really difficult for him and for me. We spoke a few times and talked about nothing serious that night, but sadly, that was the last time I talked to him. His sister called me at work a few days later to tell me that Chris had very suddenly taken his own life. I lost 40 pounds during this time due to stress. And you know what everyone at work said to me? They said, "You look great. What's your secret?" I was just like, "No food, no sleep." I mean, one day I drove home from work and I said to myself, "There's got to be a way for me to change the channel in my head somehow. There's gotta be a way to like flip a switch. You know, I gotta be able to come out of this fog." So I got home from work, I sat down on the couch, and I turned on CNN. Do not do that. Every single thing on TV is bad news. Every single thing on the radio and the newspaper is always bad news. So I only had one place left to turn, and that was the internet. I went to Google and I typed in how to start a blog before pressing the I'm feeling lucky button that no one ever presses. 10 minutes later, I had started up a tiny website called 1000awesomethings.com just as a way to put a smile on my face before I went to bed. So I would come home from work and I'd start writing a little essay about picking up a Q and U at the same time in Scrabble. And then I hit post. The next day I'd come home and write about finding $5 in your coat pocket, or about fat baseball players, or waking up and realizing it's a Saturday. Now, over 50,000 blogs are started a day, so my blog was just one of the 50,000. Nobody read it except for my mom, although I got excited when my mom forwarded it to my dad and my traffic doubled overnight. And then I got excited one day when I started getting tens of hits. And then I got excited when I started getting hundreds, and then thousands, and then millions. It just got bigger and bigger and bigger, and then I got a phone call. And the voice at the other end of the line said, "You just won the best blog in the world award." I was like, "That sounds totally fake. Obviously. Is it the Nigerian prince?" You know, but turns out it was real, and I ended up getting flown to New York City, where I walked on a red carpet between Martha Stewart on my right, Jimmy Fallon on my left, Seth Meyers and Sarah Silverman beside them. Turns out the International Academy of Digital Arts and Sciences wanted to hand me a Webby Award for Best Blog in the World. And the shock and the surprise of that was overshadowed by when I got home to Toronto and 10 literary agents were waiting in my inbox, eager to turn 1000awesomethings.com into the Book of Awesome. That's the story of where the Book of Awesome came from. I know it is a bit of a downer, and it's a sad story, which is why when the Book of Awesome first came out in print, I didn't write about it. I wanted people to jump right into the awesome things, But with almost 10 years of history behind me now, I thought it would be helpful and maybe healthy to tell you where it came from. Because if you're going through something in your life too, if you're processing a loss, if you are struggling with something, if you're trying to get into a school or just left a job you loved, if you're going through something the way we all go through something, then I hope the Book of Awesome serves you and gives you energy the way it gave energy to me. It's my collection of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of awesome things that I used to cheer myself up, and I still use today to put myself in a good mood whenever I'm feeling down. I hope you like the book.
So what's this all about? Polar ice caps are melting. Hurricanes swirl in the seas, wars are heating up around the world, and the job market is in a deep freeze. Whoa, it's getting pretty ugly out there. That's why one chilly spring night I started a tiny website called 1000 Awesome Things. For a boring guy with a 9-to-5 job, it became a getaway from my everyday. I never imagined that writing about finding money in your old coat pocket, the smell of gasoline, or watching The Price is Right when you're at home sick would amount to anything. Honestly, when I started the site, I got excited when my mom forwarded it to my dad and the traffic doubled. Then I got excited when friends sent it to friends and strangers started sending me suggestions, when cashiers open up new checkout lanes at the grocery store, the smell of rain on a hot sidewalk, waking up and realizing it's Saturday. It seems like maybe these tiny little moments make an awesome difference in many of our rushed, jam-packed lives. Maybe we all love snow days, peeling an orange in one shot and popping bubble wrap. Maybe we're basically all the same. Over the past year, the website grew into a warm place where people around the world came to curl up under a blanket and think about the small joys we often overlook. With so much sad news and bad news pouring down upon us, it's fun to stop for a minute and share a universal high five with the rest of humanity. What started on a whim has changed me for the better, too. Now, when I get the thank you wave while merging, hear the crack of ice cubes in my drink, or move clothes from the washer to the dryer without dropping anything, I just smile and enjoy the moment. So, that's the story so far. That's how we got from there to here. And now, it's time to come on in. The fire's crackling, and there's a seat on the couch here. Cuddle up, and let's all get into it. Let's all get on to it. And let's all get a little bit awesome.
The Other Side of the Pillow. Have you ever found yourself lying in bed wide awake in the middle of the night? You know how it is. Clocks clicking past 1:30 a.m. and you lie there with your eyes bugged open, chewing your upper lip, tapping the sheets with your fingers, completely frustrated. Your pupils have long adjusted to the dark, so your eyes are darting around the room over and over, trying to identify dark shapes, or watching the moonlight shadow dance around the walls. Maybe your thoughts won't settle down. You just can't get comfortable. You ate spicy food before bed. You have a presentation the next morning. Or maybe it's just the frustration itself keeping you in a terrible, never-ending cycle of sleeplessness. So you play dead and try to remain motionless as long as possible. You change positions back and forth, side to side, left to right. You get up and go to the bathroom or start reading a book. Maybe you try to remake the bed, since by now you've probably managed to twist your sheets and blankets into a completely unusable, tightly wound knot pile barely covering your legs. On nights like this, when you just can't sleep, one of the greatest things invented is simply turning over the pillow. Yes, flipping over your pillow and checking out the other side cranks bed comfort up a few notches and is a simple and easy way to help you relax and get comfy. The other side of the pillow, folks, because it's flat when you're sagging, fresh when you're stale, and cold when you're hot, baby. Awesome.
when cashiers open up new checkout lanes at the grocery store. Though I hate to admit it, I am a slow, indecisive mess in the grocery store checkout lane. Since I am an extremely cheap person, I watch the prices scroll up and scream like a hawk, often saying things like, "Oh, I thought that was on sale," or, "Actually, I don't really want that anymore," forcing the cashier to call in price checks to the unresponsive produce department or find a temporary home for the pack of melting fudgesicles I've decided to leave off my list last minute. And because I'm watching the screen so closely, I start bagging my groceries late, fumble with my wallet, and awkwardly leave my shopping cart blocking the lane like a metal crisscrossed castle knight, enforcing a firm "thou shall not pass" law in its trademark silence. Yes, I clog up the line and annoy everybody behind me. I'm one of four people you don't want to stand behind in the grocery line, together with fidgety grandma, who on cue dumps a pile of warm nickels on the counter to pay and then slowly counts them out by sliding them across the counter with her index finger. Flyer guy, who hands the cashier a dog-eared flyer from home, forcing her to manually tear out all the coupons while everybody waits. No math Jack, who sneaks in piles of extra items into the express lane and acts like it's no big deal. Those tense, winding checkout lanes can be a pretty rough go sometimes. It's not easy out there. You have to watch the anxiety levels, take deep breaths, keep that blood pressure in check. That's why there are few things better than a sprightly new cashier hopping onto the scene, grabbing the "next lane, please" sign from the end of the belt, flicking on the light bulb above her station, and offering a loud, beaming "next customer, please" to the scowling, stressed-out masses. When that cashier bulb goes on, a bright, warm glow showers down on everybody waiting. People like me feel less guilty about holding up the line, and folks at the end win the big front-of-the-line jackpot. Yes, it's one giant mood swing, one massive swelling of goodwill, complete with buzzing chatter, a few laughs, and even the occasional crinkly plastic sound of a tightly wound frown turning upside down. Awesome.
Wearing underwear just out of the dryer. Now tell me, is there anything quite so nice as wrapping yourself up in a pair of steaming skivvies just out of the dryer? It's like skinny dipping in a hot tub, jumping on a horse that's been in the sun all day, and lying on a warm sandy beach, combined. Sure, the moment doesn't last long. Yes, there may be some static cling. And it's true, you'll have to get changed really quickly in the laundry room to pull it off. But dang, girl, hot undies, they is fine. Awesome.
Old dangerous playground equipment. Slides used to be dangerous. After climbing up those sandy, metal cross-track steps, you got to the top and stared down at that steep ride below. The slide was burning hot to the touch, a stovetop set too high all day under the summer sun, just waiting to greet the underside of your legs with first-degree burns as you enjoyed the ride. It also smelled like hot pee. Years of nervous children with leaky diapers permanently marking it as their territory. Lastly, to top it all off, there were no cute plastic side rails or encapsulated tube slides, which meant that if you went too fast or aimed your legs poorly, your shoes would grip skid on the metal and you'd spill over the side, landing face down with a sickening thud in a bed of pebbles, cigarette butts, and milk thistles. It wasn't just slides, either. Everything in the playground was more dangerous, and it was different and unique, seemingly put together by the neighborhood handyman, who in a burst of creative energy one Saturday morning emptied their garages of old tires, 2x4s, and chains, and just nailed them all together. There were wooden tightrope beams suspended high in the air, daring the confident athletic kids to attempt a slow, heart-pounding high-wire walk, while other kids encouragingly showered them with handfuls of sand and pine cones. There were fire poles 2 stories high, just cheap, simple poles planted deep in the ground that were popular and educational, quietly introducing children to concepts like gravity, friction, and badly sprained ankles. There was a certain fire pole form, too, a kind of arms-on, cross-legged spider wrap maneuver that was both awkward and majestic at the same time. And, of course, there was my favorite, the big spinner, also known as a merry-go-round. This was just a giant metal circle that lay a foot off the ground and could be spun, usually by someone standing beside it. If you were lucky, you'd get a pile of kids on there, and somebody's mom or dad would kindly whip you into a world of unimaginable dizziness. A couple kids would fly off from the G-forces, but most would hang on, teeth gritted, eyes squinted, cheeks flapping wildly against the wind, until the big spinner, reluctantly, came to a slow stop, and finally led everyone off. Kids would walk away in different directions, some hitting tree trunks head-on, others falling down nearby hills. These days, those classic playgrounds sure are hard to come by. Everything is plastic now, unaffected by temperature, easy to disinfect, and bendable into all kinds of safety shapes. The sharp, rusty nail heads of yesterday, replaced with non-toxic, washable adhesives, poured from a cauldron of polymers and Purell. Now, not only are our kids getting lame, baby-approved fun, but just think what we're doing to the tetanus shot industry. Seriously, though, new playgrounds sure are terrible. Some experts say that playgrounds have become so sterile and boring that kids just walk away from them, preferring instead to hang out in the weeds by the railroad tracks, or throw bottles in the alley behind the pizza place. Children could actually be placed in more danger by these lame plastic netherworlds that encourage more video game time instead of fresh air and bruising. Another blow to childhood struck by overprotective parents and pesky lawsuits. Well, we can't change the world, so let's just enjoy the good news. Old, fun, dangerous playgrounds are not completely extinct. Yes, the safety conglomerate hasn't killed all the buzz with their rocking horses 2 inches off the ground, pillowy soft imitation sand, and stationary bolted-on steering wheels. Old, dangerous playground equipment can still be found. It's out there. So please, when you find monkey bars taunting you from 10 feet off the ground, extended seesaws that allow for maximum elevation, and rickety, sagging rope bridges with planks missing, run around like crazy, bump your head a few times, and twist your ankle. Because tell me something. Is there anything quite like it? Awesome.
Intergenerational dancing. Have you ever felt too old or too young on the dance floor? Maybe you and your husband signed up for a Saturday morning ballroom dancing class and noticed everyone else arriving on a shuttle bus from the old folks' home. Or maybe you surprised your wife with a romantic date night on your 10th wedding anniversary and accidentally stumbled into a local college hotspot full of white baseball caps, bead necklaces, and jello shooters. Or maybe you just found out the hard way that all ages usually means all underagers. I mean, if you've ever found yourself saying, "Man, I feel old here," or "Does anyone else smell Bengay?" then you know what I'm talking about. It's not that people of different age groups don't socialize. It's just that they don't often groove to the same beats as all. I think that's why wedding dance floors are a real sight. They're a breeding ground for that amazing intergenerational dancing that's just so rare and beautiful to see. You've got grandmas slow dancing with their 5-year-old grandchildren to What a Wonderful World, old men crowd surfing over a pack of sweaty teenagers, snaking conga lines of all shapes and sizes, and circles forming around anyone who happens to be doing something interesting. Whether that's a father and daughter team waltzing in circles or a slightly inebriated bridesmaid shaking her booty with a 90-year-old great-grandpa in a wheelchair. Yes, intergenerational dancing is a rare and wonderful thing. It's a magical moment where boundaries are broken and the thumping power of music sort of sweeps us all together into a tiny little place where everything's just cast aside in favor of living for the moment. Awesome!
Strategic trick-or-treating. Trick-or-treating ain't no game. No, it's a life lesson in goal-setting, planning, and tactical execution. Kids who master trick-or-treating go on to become successful world leaders. Kids who don't could possibly do the same, but have less chocolate to show for it. The point is that chocolate is delicious, and you should fill your pillowcase with as much as possible. You just have to master the four rules of strategic trick-or-treating first. 1. Mo' money, mo' problems. In terms of where to go trick-or-treating, there's always a lot of chatter about driving over to the rich neighborhood for the big score. People would have you believe that the rich enjoy lavishing children with giant cakes and full cases of root beer. But that's a lie. Rich people got rich by being cheap, and their massive front yards will just slow you down. That's right, you'll be navigating wrought iron fences, duck-shaped hedges, and koi ponds instead of ringing doorbells. Aim for the new neighborhood with little kids and the all-important, densely packed homes. 2. Dress for success. Trick-or-treating is a race against the clock. So, set yourself up for success by wearing running shoes and avoiding masks that hurt your visibility. No ballet slippers, high heels, or sandals. No robes, capes, or togas. And none of those cheap plastic masks from the dollar store that attach with a thin elastic and a couple of staples. Basically, keep simplifying your costume and timing yourself running up and down the basement stairs until you found a winner. If in doubt, go as Carl Lewis. 3. Partner up. It will be tempting to form a trick-or-treating posse and move from door to door as one big shifty amoeba of fluorescent tape and face paint. Resist that temptation. The amoeba will cause two problems. First, the group will travel at the speed of the slowest member. That means one kid with flat feet and asthma ruins everyone's night. Second, a big group triggers the rationing instinct in the people handing out candy. They become overwhelmed and default to the one for you, candy for everyone technique. You don't want that. So instead, you need to pick one partner. Qualifications for that lucky someone include a low resting heart rate, winning smile, and really cute costume. The last one is key. The costume should trigger the "aren't you adorable" reflex that inspires extra candy. Gold standard here is a fit toddler in a ladybug costume with new Reeboks. 4. Timing is everything. The last rule is all about the three key stages of Halloween candy collecting. Times may vary depending where you're from, but they go something like this. The 4 to 6 p.m. startup. You must be very active and running around here before the street gets too busy. This is your time to hit houses at the peak of their inventory levels, when people may hand out more because of excess supply or poor foresight. The 6 to 7 p.m. rest up. Streets are at their busiest. Don't get caught in other people's amoebas. Now's the time to go home and dump out the pillowcase and refresh the face paint. Also, it's a good time to hit your local fast food joints. McDonald's is usually pretty generous. The 7 to 9 p.m. cleanup. Now it's all about picking up the scraps. Some houses will be left with too much candy and people will start giving handfuls instead of fingerfuls. Others will feel guilty about running low and start handing out creative treats from their kitchen, like pudding cups, or boxes of Jell-O powder. The cleanup stage is a real test of your cardio fitness level, as many houses will have their lights turned out by now, forcing you to zigzag the street in search of the remaining bounty. Now that you've got a game plan, just remember to keep it clean out there. Under cover of night and camouflage face paint, some folks venture into the murky trick-or-treating ethical gray zone. Stay away from these folks, because while they're telling people that today's their birthday too, collecting a second bag for a sick sibling at home, or body-checking toddlers into bushes on their way up the walk, you can rest knowing that you came out to play by the rules. And you won! Awesome!
Seeing a cop on the side of the road, and realizing you're going the speed limit anyway. Stress level goes up, stress level goes down. Awesome.
Illegal naps. You know what's even better than lying on a hammock in the backyard on a sunny Saturday afternoon? Better than catching a few winks after class before a long night out at the bars? Better than falling asleep on the couch with the baseball game on the radio? You know what's even better than all that? I'll tell you what. Illegal naps, my friend. Sneaking them in when you ain't supposed to. Napping anytime you know you shouldn't be napping has a bit of an edgy, dangerous feel to it. Like sneaking into a movie, sharing a free refill soda at a family restaurant, or coming through customs without declaring the new sweater you're wearing. I'm talking about driving away from work at lunchtime, parking in a nearby parking lot, tilting back your driver's seat, and sneaking in a little siesta before an afternoon full of meetings. I'm talking about waking up groggily at 11 a.m. after a long night, chomping on handfuls of cold popcorn while surfing the internet for an hour, then going back to the bedroom to crash all afternoon, building toward that exotic and sinful day o' naps. Yes. I'm talking about the naps you pull off in the bathroom stall at work, the ones at the back of the bus just before your stop, and the naps you take in the middle of a big bout of procrastination before a deadline, when you convince yourself that a quick snooze will give you more energy to finish that big paper due in a few hours. So come on, if you're with me, then you agree. Life's just too short not to sleep when you feel like it. So lower those blinds, unplug that alarm clock, and nap strong, nap long, and nap proud, my friends. Awesome.
When you get the milk to cereal ratio just right, things could go a few different ways near the bottom of that cereal bowl. One, drowning in white. You poured too fast and overfilled the bowl. Now, after you spoon up the soggy O's, you're left with an inch of sloshy, super-saturated, sandy-colored syrup at the bottom. Well, the damage is done, so I say bottoms up to that. Just tilt your head, tilt your bowl, and say hello to a peppy morning full of jitters and fast talking. 2. Cornflake Beach. Here's where you end up with too much cereal and not enough milk. You first notice it when you're halfway through your bowl and those flakes seem a bit too crunchy for their own good. So you look down and notice you're swimming in the wading pool, my friend. Assuming you're out of milk or are very lazy, you have to frantically start rationing, aiming for just enough milk in each spoonful to get by. Let's hope you make it. And don't end up with a fat lump of slightly damp cornflakes sitting pathetically on the side of your bowl. 3. Cereal Bowl Bliss. Oh, mama. This here's the perfect milk-to-cereal jackpot. Maybe you're like my friend Mew, who has lifted the art of obtaining cereal bowl bliss to a noble, decades-long search for perfection. Yes, he has studied milk absorption for years and knows that a bowl of Fruit Loops and a bowl of Frosted Flakes have nothing in common, other than a mascot who lives in the jungle. See, Mew points out that those Fruit Loops float high and dry, while Frosted Flakes are like crispy sponges that require a lot more milk to make it through. And then there's the bowl itself. Sure, a big, deep bowl may look great when you pull it out of the cupboard, but watch out for the illusion of size. You may end up drowning in white if you're not careful. Lastly, if you're ready for advanced milking, you may be interested in the patient art of the sit, which involves letting your beautiful bowl of cereal lie on the counter for a good minute or two before eating. This allows your cereal to soak up a consistent amount of milk and prevents those dreaded bone-dry first bites of crunchiness that offset your whole ratio. Remember, this is advanced milking, folks, not for the faint of heart or extremely hungry. Anyway, when you get the milk-to-cereal ratio just right at breakfast, you're all aces, my friend. And when you hit it, you hit it. And you know you hit it, because that last spoonful goes down smooth without a hint of drowning in white or surfing up onto Cornflake Beach. Awesome.
High-fiving babies. Because they don't usually leave you hanging. Awesome.
When you're awkwardly standing by yourself with a full cafeteria tray of food, and then suddenly spot your friend waving at you. The dreaded cafeteria standalone. Blue plastic tray wobbling in both hands, carrying a big rolling glass of iced tea, and a heavy ceramic plate loaded with steaming roast beef, wet mashed potatoes, and bland baby carrots. You exit the cafeteria line and glance at the full crowd in front of you. It's the high school cafeteria, the workplace lunchroom, or the food court at the mall. Everybody is laughing, at you, maybe, while you stand and stare out at the kaleidoscope sea of smiling faces. As the seconds tick by, you feel more and more out of place. Maybe you quickly glance around the room while pretending to get ketchup. Maybe you walk in a couple different directions so you aren't clogging up the lanes or looking too obvious. Or maybe you just get really anxious and wonder if you're going to have to sit by yourself. But just as you're beginning to lose hope, you eventually see them. It's your friends in the distance, and they're waving. Awesome.
Having a whole row to yourself on the plane. It was like a mirage. There I was a few years ago, sitting in the middle seat of a plane set for takeoff, an empty aisle seat to my right. I was belted in and cramped, and it just sat there vacant, while overhead bins were slamming shut, flight attendants were bringing out blankets, and passengers started thumbing mindlessly through in-flight magazine articles about exotic hotel lobbies. The plane looked full. The plane looked settled. So I quickly made my stealth ninja-like swap into the empty seat like a champion. I moved and sat there with a big smile, lots of elbow room, and my legs comfortably extended into the aisle. Truly, it was heaven. Then suddenly, a big guy in a tight business suit lumbered down the aisle, just heaving, sweat dripping down his forehead, tongue wagging out of his mouth like a dog, eyeing my row from a distance. I knew the jig was up, so I moved back to the middle seat as he settled in. Turns out, he slept through his alarm and had to race to the airport. Nope, no time for a shower, just a full day's worth of grease on his glistening neck. I voluntarily sacrificed the armrest when his forehead began dripping on me, and then tried to enter a cocoon-like state of flying hibernation, covering myself in a blanket, crossing my arms and legs, and trying to go to sleep. And that's sort of how most plane rides go for me. But every so often,
every once in a while, I'll end up on a pretty empty plane and score an entire row to myself. And that's when the perks start piling up. You know how it is. Pee freely. Yup. Get up and go whenever you like, because you won't need to awkwardly limbo past anyone's drink tray. Bonus, no awkward crotch-in-the-face moments. Window and aisle. It's great looking out the window. But unfortunately, the person sitting closest generally gets all window shade rights. They may close the window completely or block the view when you want to peek. When you get your own row, though, you get both. Rest your arms. All armrests become yours for the taking. Left arm, right arm, it doesn't matter. There's no need to worry about getting the bump off. Go sideways. This isn't always easy, but you might be able to pull off the row nap, where you flip up all the armrests and turn three seats into a bed. Forget those pricey lie-down seats in first class. This here's the Econorest, and it works just as well. Yes, having a whole row to yourself on the plane is a pretty sweet deal. You can almost pretend that you're magnificently rich and paid for the other seats just to buy yourself some breathing room. Because let's be honest, flying ain't always a lot of fun. And that extra elbow room can make the difference between 3 hours of misery and 3 hours of bliss. And that's something worth celebrating. Awesome.
Popping bubble wrap. Okay, trivia time. What were the two inventors of bubble wrap trying to make instead of packaging material back in 1957 at the Sealed Air Corporation? Take a guess, and let's see what you got before we reveal the answer in just a jiffy. For the patient folks, let's chat for a moment about different ways to do the deed. 1. Old-time classic. Your average pop, just squeezing it in your hands with a satisfied smile on your face. Nothing flashy here, folks. Just a thumb, some fingers, and lots of satisfying pops. 2. The Big Bang. A trickier move. This one requires delicately wrapping the unpopped bubble wrap into a tight ball and then hugging the whole thing against your body really hard. Do this before 10 p.m. so you don't wake the neighbors. 3. Walk This Way. You'll need a large piece of bubble wrap for this one, likely from a new TV or fridge that got delivered to your house. Just pull the wrap out, lay it down on the floor, take off your socks, and walk all over it. Walk back and forth, walk in circles, just don't stop the walking, because you can't stop the popping. When the pops slow down, you may have to inspect the wrap closely for any leftover bubbles and take care of those one by one. 4. The Office Pop. Here's where you lay it down on the floor of your cubicle and roll over it with your office chair all afternoon. Believe me, your coworkers will love it. 5. The Twister. Roll it up like a carpet and twist your hands in opposite directions really hard. When you're done, you'll have a nice, well-popped area in the center of your wrap, and we'll have to move on to a new section. 6. Mini pops. Sometimes you expect to pull out a big, fat mess of bubble wrap, and out comes a thin little sheet of mini bubbles instead. But sometimes, that's all you get, man. So do a few mini pops and enjoy it. My friends, loudly popping bubble wrap is a great joy in life. It's a satisfying stress reliever, a fun surprise, and a rare little moment to act like a kid during a boring day at the office or while unpacking after a hectic move. So aren't you glad they made bubble wrap into packing material and not textured wallpaper instead? Awesome.
Being the first table to get called up for the dinner buffet at a wedding. Weddings can go one of two ways. Either you're tight like twins with the bride or groom, a sibling maybe, college roommate, or grandmother. You're on the inside, recommending photographers, hosting showers, renting tuxes, giving toasts. For you, the wedding is a great day, a proud moment, a chance to recognize and celebrate someone you love dearly. Or you're on the outside. You're the groom's doctor, the bride's new boss, or, worst of all, the cousin date. You're only there because it would have been rude not to invite you. So you RSVP past the deadline, squeeze into dress clothes from prom, and drink before the reception. You sit at the back table with a lot of people you don't know and introduce yourself to at least one half of the newly married couple late at night on the dance floor during a sweaty party song. "You look really great," you scream over the thumping beats, a nearly full beer swinging wildly in your hand. "I'm Corey, by the way. I work with Linda." If you're on the inside, the entire wedding is wonderful. You cry during speeches, take 200 pictures, and dance until the lights come up. Your hair sweat glued to your forehead, big toes popping through fresh holes in your nylons at 2 in the morning. If you're on the outside, you're scoping out bridesmaids, eating other people's wedding favorite chocolates, and ordering off the menu at the bar. When you're on the outside, there is no greater wedding high than being the first table called up to the dinner buffet. Suddenly, you're on the inside. Honorary winner of the prestigious Gets to Eat Before Everyone Else Award. Dipping your ladle into Alfredo sauce before it film's over. Toothpicking meatballs before they congeal into sugary meat pyramids. And surgically removing the perfect first triangle of cheesecake before the dish gets gummed up with clumpy graham cracker paste and sticky cherry glue. It sure is a great feeling getting first dibs on that long table of piping hot steam trays. After all, it means you don't have to watch everybody else casually walk by you with full plates while you salivate and attempt to make small talk about where everybody is from and how beautiful the centerpieces look. Yes. If you're up first, you walk back to your table a newly crowned king, sitting down at your chair facing the bathroom at table 57 throne, lord and ruler of your much-too-loaded plate of rolled-up salami, potato salad, and gherkins. Awesome!
When someone lands on the hotel you just built in Monopoly. Shelling out for that primo real estate on the corner lot ain't always easy. Yes, you may have to mortgage electric company or dip into that stash of hundreds hidden under the game board. But after you make your big investment, there's nothing finer than somebody landing right plumb on it. Right plumb on their next turn. And there's always a new bit of tension on that first roll after a hotel enters the game too. No more super quick circling and buying properties, collecting get out of jail cards, and winning second place in beauty contests. No, now there's a hotel on the board, and you enter round two of Monopoly, where the haves and have-nots are quickly and ruthlessly divided. When someone lands on the hotel you just built, the first thing they do is get real quiet and quickly pass the dice to the next player, sort of hoping you don't notice that they're squatting on your joint. But you notice, all right. And maybe you're even all polite and nonchalant about it, too. Oh, Marvin Gardens. Hold on a second. Wait. Yeah, sorry. Let's see here. That'll be $1,200, please. What? Seriously? Yeah, sorry. It's the hotel that does it. Passing the property card over for inspection. Inspecting property card. That's crazy. That's like all my money. I might have to mortgage Baltic Avenue. I'm sorry, man. I'll take all the railroads instead if you want. Disgusted. What? No way. Then I'll just have Baltic and the Blues. Forget it. That's crazy. Fine. $1,200, please. Angrily and slowly counting out and handing you a thick stack of hundreds, twenties, tens, fives, and ones that barely add up to $1,200, leaving them with only a few properties and two $10 bills. Awesome.
Finding a mixtape given to you by an old boyfriend or girlfriend. Stashed away in shoeboxes, basements, and broom closets around the world are some of our greatest treasures. That's where we might find old prom photos, expired driver's licenses, handwritten letters from faraway friends, or maybe, if we're really lucky, one of those beautiful gems known as a love tape. Love tapes are simply any mixtape carefully put together by someone who likes you. Yes, that blurry, distant boyfriend or girlfriend probably spent hours timing everything to fit perfectly, waiting for songs to play on the radio, painstakingly scrawling out notes and drawings, and maybe, if you're lucky, even spraying it with a bit of perfume. Depending on your time frame, your mixtape may contain gems such as 1. The Righteous Brothers' Unchained Melody. 2. Extreme, More Than Words. 3. Bryan Adams' Everything I Do It For You. 4. UB40, I Can't Help Falling In Love With You. 5. Whitney Houston, I Will Always Love You. 6. Meatloaf, I'd Do Anything For Love, But I Won't Do That. 7. Celine Dion, My Heart Will Go On. 8. Bob Marley, Is This Love. 9. Boys to Men, End of the Road. 10. Jewel, You Were Meant for Me. 11. Green Day, Good Riddance, Time of Your Life. 12. Cyndi Lauper, Time After Time. 13. The Bangles, Eternal Flame. 14. Rod Stewart, Have I Told You Lately? 15. Leanne Rimes, How Do I Live? 16. Bon Jovi, Bed of Roses. 17. Guns N' Roses, November Rain. 18. Milli Vanilli, Girl, You Know It's True. 19. Sinead O'Connor, Nothing Compares to You. 20. Mr. Big, To Be With You. So search your heart, search your soul, and when you find mixtapes there, you will search no more. So don't tell me they're not worth looking for. You can't tell me they're not worth hunting for. You know it's true. Everything mixtapes do, they do it for you. Awesome.
Picking the perfect nacho off someone else's plate. No two nachos were created equal. When someone offers you a nacho from their appetizer plate at a restaurant or while on the couch at home in front of a movie, you need to move fast. 1. First up, quickly scan their entire plate. At what stage is this offer being made? Are you in the game when the plate is hot and full? Or are we dealing with mostly crumbs and surplus jalapenos at this point? Size up the prize and give a quick yes or no. 2. Now, if you're going in, don't wait too long to make your move. If it's obvious you're putting too much thought into it, you'll come across as selfish. Definitely don't move any toppings around to build yourself a massive all-in salad nacho, but there's no need to pull out that bland naked chip at the bottom of the Jenga stack either. You weren't offered crumbs, and you don't deserve crumbs. Remember that. 3. Next up, locate your prey and dive in. Everyone has their personal preferences, though I'm a big fan of 90 to 100% melted cheese coverage and about 25 to 50% salsa coverage. Any less cheese coverage and it's just taco shell to me. Any more salsa coverage and I feel like I'm drinking the stuff. And hey, if I grab an olive, green onion, or jalapeno, that's great too, but I don't push my luck. Lastly, for my money, you can keep that shredded lettuce. That's just grated water in my book. Bottom line, know your tastes, size up the game, and dig in quickly. Mastering that perfect pick is a valuable life skill. Now go grab life by the nachos. Awesome.
The moment at a concert after the lights go out and before the band comes on stage. You go early. You grab a drink. You buy a t-shirt. You find your seat or you edge up to the stage. You listen to the opening act. You people watch. You watch. You talk to your friends. You guess what songs they might play.
And then the moment finally arrives. The background music fades down, all the lights suddenly go out, and there's total blackness. You feel a massive wave of anticipation sweep across the crowd. People stand up, raise their arms, and scream, and everyone clamors for that first view of the band walking on stage. Awesome.
Finding out your birthday is on a Friday or Saturday next year. Planning those Wednesday birthdays is tough. Do you party back on the weekend before or party forward to the weekend after? Either way, you'll get a lot of, "So wait, when's your actual birthday?" questions, and you'll be forced to take a sip of your drink, smile pleasantly, and casually say, "Oh, just a couple days from now." Or worse, "Oh, you know, 2 Wednesdays ago. That's just no fun. So, if you're as self-centered as I am, and the first thing you do when you get your greasy paws on a crisp new calendar is flip right to your birthday, then you sure are loving it when that big day hits the Friday or Saturday jackpot. Now it's on for so many reasons. Save the date. No need to puzzle over when to throw the big bash. Just start planning it for that Friday or Saturday. You have no choice, and no need to waffle. Party priority. It's true. When it's your actual birthday, your event moves way up the party priority list. Sure, you're still slightly below friend's wedding or out-of-town guest, but you zoom up way higher than poker night or sports team banquet. More free drinks. Especially if you have a birthday party that starts the night before and kicks into high gear at midnight when you officially start celebrating. Hopefully you don't have to wear a tiara and a sash to keep those free shots coming. Yes, you know as well as I do that when that big day lands right on a Friday or Saturday, it opens up a world of celebration possibilities. Because now your birthday's going on, your birthday's going long, and your birthday's going strong, foo. Oh, yeah. Awesome.
Fixing electronics by smacking them. My room was above the kitchen growing up. Late at night, lying in bed, I would listen to the creaks and cracks through the vents and floorboards. Oven burners wobbled and popped, distant thumps echoed from the furnace room, and the fridge cranked its whirring motor on and off whenever it pleased. It was always funny to me that during the day that fridge didn't put up much of a fight. If it started clinking and whirring, you just pounded it with your fist and it would stop. One hard punch to the kidneys of the thing, and it just sort of whimpered and stayed quiet. Like the fawns kicking the jukebox in Happy Days, Grandpa smacking the TV during Wheel of Fortune, or a bandana-clad mom shaking the washer when the heavy towel load gets it rocking, there is something great about fixing electronics by smacking them. I mean, for once, our instincts work. That doesn't always happen in nature. Slap a bear on the snout when it's picking through your trash, and you might get a friendly mauling. Pull your brother's hair when he steals your Xbox controller, and you could find your toothbrush tossed in the toilet. But when the CD is skipping in the car, a friendly smack might do the trick. So how about that? Also, it kind of makes you feel handy. I don't know about you, but I don't know much about electronics. I have no understanding of how telephones work, how airplanes take off, or how radio signals go about their day. I have trouble putting the chain back on my bicycle, resetting the microwave clock, or starting the barbecue. You should see me out there, turning the gas on and off, tossing in matches and jumping away, half expecting the whole thing to blow up. But I'm not bad at smacking things. I can smack a computer, I can smack a dishwasher, and I've got a lot of experience if your fridge seems to be giving you trouble. So listen, If you're with me on this, throw your hand up for a smacking high five and give cheers to your inner handyman. Awesome.
Hitting a bunch of green lights in a row. I used to drive home from my friend Mike's basement apartment on this lonely two-lane road. It was always late at night, and I'd roll down the windows so that the cold country time air could help keep me awake. The air smelled like a cologne Beetlejuice might wear, a tangy combination of fresh manure, foggy dew, and squashed skunk. Yes, I'd say it was a nice, quiet way to end an evening, a relaxing and peaceful drive home on those late nights. But then, they came. The big box stores gobbled up that cheap farmer land and dropped in a concrete paradise full of parking lots, neon signs, and a never-ending series of traffic lights that completely clogged up the roads. The cold farm air was replaced by a new smell, a thick, heady mix of car exhaust and fried chicken. And you know, I understand. Every massive parking lot really does need its own traffic light. I mean, without them, you'd be stuck trying to make a left turn out of Home Depot for half an hour. You buy those 2x4s. You want to go build that deck. Am I right? No, really, I get it. I've been there too, and I get the lights. But let's be honest. The resulting gauntlet is no good either. On that old drive home from Mike's basement apartment, they built up more than 10 traffic lights in a row, each only about a couple hundred feet apart. There was traffic light after traffic light after traffic light, a sort of slow death march through the jungle of progress. And the lights never lined up. You'd hit two greens, then two reds. You'd race through a couple of last-second yellows, and then get your comeuppance with five reds in a row. Yes, it was a frustratingly, fuel-wastingly stop-and-go-too-slow ordeal. Now, one night, I was driving home from Mike's place a little later than usual. We started a movie when we should have called it a night, and I was trucking home at 3 a.m. on a Tuesday. I approached the gauntlet groggily and hit the first few green lights in a row, no problem. Nothing special, I figured. Probably just a tease. After all, the gauntlet had never lost. But then, before I knew it, I had made a couple more. Then, a couple more. Then, a couple more. Suddenly, I was two lights away from the finish line, and I couldn't believe my luck. Looking ahead, I could see that both lights were green, tempting me, showing me what might be possible. So I gunned it. I blew through the second-to-last green and saw that final one turn to yellow. Oh, there was no way I was going to get that close without making it through, so I punched the gas and barely squeezed by as the light turned red. Although almost running a red wasn't the smartest move in the book, making it through the gauntlet was one of the greatest accomplishments of my life. I was buzzing huge that night and smiling ear to ear. And really, just tell me the truth. If you've ever blown through a string of green lights in a row, how does it make you feel? I've got just one guess. Awesome.
When you push the button for the elevator and it's already there. Ding. Awesome.
Bakery air. Bakery air is that steaming hot front of thick, buttery fumes waiting for you just inside the door of a bakery. And I am just going to tell you straight up, that is some fine air. Bakery air immediately fills you up with the sickly sweet smell of rising cupcakes, crisping croissants, and the distinct aroma of globby oatmeal turning into a delicious tray of sugary brown cookies. It's a powerful and intoxicating smell that rivals some of the best smells out there. Late-night summer barbecue, new car smell, gasoline, fresh baby, or even, dare I say it, campfire in the woods. Yes, I went there. Now, Is it just me, or do you ever feel sorry for the people working in the bakery? You know, because they might just get used to the smell and stop enjoying those hot bakery whiffs all the time. I really hope it's not like that.